Hi, if I could take a moment of your time before we start, if you've enjoyed previous episodes or if you enjoy this episode, if you could subscribe on the platform that you listen to, that would be really helpful. It helps us get more guests and push the podcast forward. Thanks.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Car Chat Podcast. I'm Sam Moores. And with us today, we have Justin Bell. Hello.
Hey, mate. How are you? Nice to meet you, actually.
Yeah, nice to meet you, too. Can you tell the listeners a little bit about sort of who you are and what you do?
Yeah, it's funny when you do something, especially, I mean, I know anyone can listen around the world to any podcast, but especially for a British audience, because I feel like I'm the guy that left and never came back. you know, it's like when I go to Goodwood, I'm totally like, who the hell are you? So I second generation race car driver. You probably heard of my dad, Derek Bell. So 5-time winner of Le Mans and all that stuff, and which I'm very proud of. So I have no problem saying it like that. Not any dark, deep family, you know, guilt trip or something. But and, you know, I raced my whole life from 18, 19 years old, from Formula Ford, being on the grid with Alan McNeish, Mika Häkkinen, and all the way through their careers. Obviously, went the one way, I went another. Talk about that. But came to America, which was pretty successful for me. But the big heyday years for me with the Dodge Viper years back with the Arika team. Arika, we won Le Mans, we won the World Championship. It was just an extraordinary run through the end of the 90s. And then, over here in America, won Trans Am Rookie of the Year, podiumed at Daytona. I mean, everything was seeming to go quite well. And then, you know, careers change and dry up and do different things. But I was really, I started being interviewed a lot, and I was the good interviewee. I was the guy that was good value for the money, you know. So they'd always come to me in the middle of the night in the pit lane because they knew I'd not shut up. And then eventually I knew that was what I wanted to do. So I got the opportunity when my teammate, I was doing Grand Am, which is the IMSA series at the time, as it was called, racing in the prototype division. Wonderful man called Roger Schramm, gentleman driver. But, you know, just a bit disillusioning demotivating when you get the car into the top 4 or 5 and then, you know, you get in and you drop it back down and then you do that. That was the game, I guess. It was, you know, you put your heart and soul into it. And then you take a check and go home and go, God, is that my whole life? Is that what it all amounted to? But still very fortunate to do it. But then he had a very bad skiing accident after Daytona, which opened me up to, I'm getting paid for the year, but now I could go to not drive effectively. I could go to Speed Channel as it was and say, I want to be a full-time broadcaster. And they took me on and that was 12 years ago or something. And so I've basically been the TV guy over here and all kind of got famous for my pit walks at Le Mans, and, you know, engaging with the fans. I'm not the technical reporter. I'm the funny guy. And then branched into the web stuff as everyone does. And I have, you know, quite a few different shows now, as well as doing a lot of branded content for people, which is a sort of weird skill to be able to work for a Lexus or Mercedes or whoever, Jag, Land Rover, whoever, and, you know, deliver content in a way that isn't like down your throat bullshit. You know, you try and make it sound as though you're, you know, you're doing it genuinely. So
that is,
a man of all trades really right now, but all communication based.
Mm. Okay, let's sort of wind back a little bit and then sort of go through a bit. So racing, was there, I guess there was no real sort of, not necessarily option, but in terms of like your dad was so successful in it, you probably were like, my idol, this is what I want to do, crack on. Was that
how yeah, it sort of I went? Mean, in a way, but not when I was young, you know. I mean, I raced motocross. And school would be motocross because dad was off driving. So my sort of one of my best friends, his best friend, John Penfold, his son, James, and he and I would go motocross riding in Portsmouth Schoolboy Scramble Club. And I was a good club rider, but I knew I was never going to be, that wasn't going to be a career. You know, when these, there was this guy this time, this we were at Langrish, which was like our local track, and I was really freaking good there. And then this little blonde kid turned up in a, which I now realize was just like a panel van, but it was very fancy for, you know, schoolboy motocross. And he had his, you know, Kawasaki teen green all over it. And this little blonde kid, about half my height, just pissed off into the distance. Like, was jumping over things. We would kind of do this over. He'd take off, clear five jumps in a row. And I remember thinking, well, sod this for Game of Soldiers. I don't think I'm going to make get paid to do this. and then the racing thing. Actually, James, my other best mate, who from school, he took me to his dad and I went to the and him went to the Formula Ford Festival 1600 Festival. I'm like, oh my god, these are guys my age. I could do this.
Yeah.
Whereas I'd only ever been to real racetracks. Big races with dad, you know, Silverstone, 1,000 kilometers, or Nürburgring, or Le Mans. I mean, that sounds like privilege, but I didn't know how you got there. I just thought, didn't everyone's dad do it in a way? So that's when I decided to go racing, to the severe disappointment of my mum. And I think, in a way, the disappointment of my dad. He was proud of it, but he knew it was about to cost him some money and a whole load of aggro at home. So I think he'd rather I'd be more intelligent than, you know, I don't know, I'm a tennis player, whatever. You know, not a doctor.
Do you have kids, right?
Yeah.
Do you? Because I've just had a little baby who's like 8 months old, and I was chatting to my wife about this of like, well, I would like him to be, you know, pursue various things and whatever, but like I kind of don't want him to be like that good at like sports or. Car racing sounds like a horrific idea. Like all these things, you're like, that's going to like take a lot of money, time and effort when like, you could just like cruise through and have a nice time and all that.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I will say to people, you know, when kids ask me, oh, I want to be a racing driver and they're go-karting and stuff. And I look at the dad and I say, are you rich? And they go, oh, no, I'm, you know, whatever, electrician. And I go, do you know rich people? Well, not really. And then I look at the kid and say, are you like, you know, Lando Norris, good, out of the box, or Raikkonen, and also, and I mean, I'm winning some races. Oh, that's good. I said, well, the other advice is just go do well in business, become rich, and you can race anything you want. Actually, not Formula One.
Yeah.
But, you know, you could get into top levels of sports car racing if you, as a gentleman driver, pro-am, there's many people that have. That's the guaranteed one. And by the way, when we're all going back on, you know, EasyJet, you'll be in your own plane. So it's way better. It's a much better way of going racing. But you're onto something there with sport. Right? I know we're not really answering my question about my dad and me. But the whole thing about sport is it's this incredible, especially for young kids, this incredible character builder, right? It shows them discipline and focus and physical training and how. But the number of jobs at the end of it, if you think, you know, it's going to be a J-O-B, it's really tough. I don't know. There's not many, Lawrence Strolls as dads out there, you know, and I think it's brilliant for kids, but I think there comes a point you have to go, this isn't your job, my son or my daughter. This is an amazing training environment for the rest of your life, but you're going to need a real job. But saying that, I, of course, was pre-social media and pre all that. And so you thought you could do whatever you wanted. And, there was still no context to it. You know, there was no you weren't aware of the options, really. I mean, I wanted to do film and TV from quite an early age and be involved. I'd like to have been an actor, I guess, or something, but I never pursued it. But in my older age, I think I kind of do my fair share of acting and what I do as a TV host. But, you know, when you're getting involved in a swallow that, you just, you know, I didn't think about making money. I just thought, I really want to do this. Yeah. And so Burt Rigg, a little Formula Ford, and my first sponsor, Graham Burrows, who's a property developer in Bognor Regis, Pagham. And off we went, 50 grand sponsorship, two championships for $50,000. Pounds, you know, I mean, Townsend, Torreson, and the P&O. I mean, it was amazing, really. That was 24 races for 50 grand, right? Unheard of. You can't do karting, any kind of karting for that. And next thing, I'm off the races, really, and this thing started going quite well. But it wasn't obvious. The other reason it wasn't obvious, Sam, was because whereas a lot of other people may have being inspired to go racing, other kids, because they looked at Autosport and you'd watch Formula One, listen to Murray Walker, and you just thought it was glamorous. You know, I was exposed to the negative side, which was, you know, people dying that were friends of ours, you know, close friends, my parents crying about it, my mum and dad fighting over the fatalities, over the risk, over the reward, being pulled out of school, private school, because dad had no money, because driving took a shit for him for a while. You know what I mean? It was just like, I was more educated about my decision to go racing than maybe just someone sitting at home. So people say it was just for the girls and the glamour, but actually I knew the other side of it and the girls.
That's quite an interesting outlook on it. And I've not really thought about that, but like I have a family member as a politician and they asked me like, young days, are you interested in politics / want to have anything to do with politics? And from a young age, we were getting dragged around the country, going to this and that and doing all this stuff and seeing the media and whatever. And just like, no, I couldn't want to get any further from it. It just seems horrific.
Yeah. Just an awful.
So yeah, that's an interesting.
Awful thing. But you know, you are shaped so much by your parents, aren't you, as in your interests. And I think it's quite, I'm more aware now, obviously, and you just started on the kid thing. I'm more aware now. My son's 18 and my daughter's 15 and a half, Tallulah and Oliver. And I'm realizing how formative the exposure is that we give them to our own passions. I mean, how many kids are, you know, it's really cool when, you know, like my girlfriend, she's totally into cars. And her dad and her were, and I think it was probably a bit of a pain in the backside for her being him being so into cars when she was younger. But now, you know, it's what she does. It's like osmosis, right? And there's a responsibility to that. So yeah, open your kids' eyes to everything. But in, you know, this whole social media side of things, you think, oh, well, I'm just going to go into karting. My dad and mum are going to go into debt, and then I'm going to drive Formula One. It's going to be easy. It's just not. Drivers stay in their seats for a long time. I'm not saying don't have the dream, but geez, it's those easier dreams.
It's a really interesting sport. I mean, there's a debate I have with some of my friends about whether it is a sport for like, and like you can toss it both ways. And because like one of the things is, and I don't know what necessarily defines a sport, but the money element is such, it just makes and breaks it for, well, pretty much everyone. Like, it doesn't matter how far up the tree you are, you still need money, whether it's from someone else or whatever, to play.
I'd say, you know, Dad, I remember him talking about it when I was really young. You know, even members of his family were, he'd got an MBE for it and won Le Mans 5 times, and his family was still like, when are you going to get a job? You know, and because he's like, actually, I do all right doing exactly what I do. But he, you know, there was no one in the early days of racing that didn't have money of some kind to start racing. That, you know, it was a gentleman's activity that you then became kind of professional at. But from the Bentley boys to Sterling Moss to, you know, I mean, a lot of them came into it with no money, but you'd still need someone to give you a hand, you know. I mean, James Hunt with Lord Hesketh. I mean, you know, there's everyone has sort of had these mentors of some kind, especially before sponsorship. But it is definitely, I think, the couple of ways of defining what a sport is. One is it does provide entertainment. People follow
100%.
It. There's people are empowered by watching it, and it brings huge entertainment to tens and tens of millions of people. So, you know, that puts it in the sport category. The level of fitness of these drivers, the technology battle that goes on between the teams, I think, does money equal better entertainment? No, it doesn't. I mean, you watch IndyCar, their racing is just as good as Formula One. But Formula One has brilliantly positioned it into being the elite sport, right? I mean, how many crap races did we used to watch at Formula One when there was no overtaking? We still watched it every weekend. And after every race, you go, I'm never watching that again. But you'd watch that. You know, now at least we have amazing racing and some really great characters. But yeah, it is a sport as much as, I don't know, paddleboard might be in the Olympics, right? I mean, I don't know.
It's yeah.
It's a sport.
No, it is. And it is, like you say, the point, if you say you start a big company and you do very well for yourself, you can go and do some of these really cool things. Like you can go to Le Mans and, yeah, you need to work your way up in cars or whatever, and you can race an LMP2 car. If you've got enough money, you could race LMP1.
You can get LMP1. I mean, it is the only professional sport where that can happen. I mean, you don't go, you know, you're not handling
polo.
Polo, very true. You know, here is Tiger Woods on the first tee of the US Open, and there is Justin Bell, a gynecologist from Ohio who is really enjoying his golf game and is on the first tee with Tiger Woods. You go, what the fuck is this guy doing here? But, you know, in sports car racing, you have that. You know, I remember you used to have my racing school at a Viper, then a Corvette racing school. I'd be teaching these guys, and I'd be like, God, you can't drive a stick up a dog's bum, you know. And then a year later, I'd be at Daytona, and this guy, I remember, this is a true story, this guy's walking towards me in a race suit, and he goes, do you remember me? And I go, yeah, I'm scarred by it. And he goes, oh, I'm in the GTD race. Wow. I mean, that's on the banking with Christensen and Montoya and McNeish. Yeah. And I go, what? But that's our sport. And, you know, for every one of those shouldn't be there, you know, moments, there's a lot of amazingly talented guys who, isn't it interesting, answer the question on behalf of a lot of other people. You know, if I'd started younger, I could have been someone. That, there's some genuinely fast drivers in the pro-am category, right? And you go, if you'd started when you were 18, you would have been bloody good, you know?
And there's another interesting aspect to that, and there is a clear difference between professional and am, and like whatever level of am. Okay, the top ams do start to cross over, but you're getting professional any day, any track, any car, any conditions. Lap one, generally, incredibly fast. Whereas the AMs, that's not necessarily the case. But it's a really unique sport in the sense that you can start late in life, young in life, whatever, and you can get to within what seems in terms of numbers very close to a professional in like not that long. In terms of the grand scheme of things, in terms of hours, like you can take a complete novice and get them to within a half second of a pro, depending on the car, GT3 maybe, in like not that long. It's just got to be commitment time. They've got to be, you know, on it.
They've got to be on it.
But it is possible, isn't it?
Right. Yeah. So my rebuttal to that is based on, you know, 30 years since I did the Derek Bell Porsche driving school. I was one of the little coaches back then as a 20-year-old here in America. Then having my own racing school. Then doing private coaching, which I don't like doing. But now, all the way to today, driving with other journalists on track in more visceral linear cars, the cars of 10, 15, 20 years ago, that gap was this large.
Yeah.
You would be 4 seconds off my pace if we went in a new McLaren to Silverstone. If I took you in, if I'd taken you in the our Le Mans winning GTR when it's in road spec, right? You know, the 95 car to Silverstone, you'd have shit your pants. Even I don't care how common, you would have been 6 to 8 seconds off and you would have been trying really hard. In today's car, with the technology, if you're in a new GT3 or GT4 Porsche, it's extraordinary. I mean, you can get in a McLaren 600 LT or whatever. Your technology is giving you so much confidence. It's, I mean, there's hundreds of millions, right, of electronic impulses doing things, reading data, doing things. You're like, oh, this is doing it. Look at me. Oh, wow. Look at me come out of cops. I'm fucking brilliant here. But meanwhile, the car's doing a zillion things at once, from the hydroelectric magnetic dampers to the diff altering the torque to the front wheel, so you're not even feeling it, to the steering input changing. I'm right. So the gap is so narrow. But throw everyone into Dodge Vipers from 1994 and say, go at it. The gap with no ABS, no traction control, no nothing. The gap would be back down to 4 or 5 seconds. But it's put a lot of problem for the coaches, Sam. A lot of problem for the coaches. Because now you're sitting next to the neurosurgeon or whoever who is or the stockbroker who is your client, and he's getting up to speed. And he's like looking at the data going, what, you're Darren Turner? I thought you would be better than this. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I mean, I know this because like my best mate, James Guest, owns Base, a simulator company with Darren. James races an Aston Martin, has done the last couple of years in whatever British championship it was. And Darren comes and does some races with them. And he's like, Darren will be on it. I mean, just as you say, that difference between a pro, like first lap out, Darren's off in the weeds, way quicker. And then the gap will come down and you look at the data and you go, well, I'm quicker than him there, out of the hairpin. I'm quicker than him, in the middle of whatever corner. But that would not happen back in the day.
Yeah. No, get on like in a race.
And racing then separates it, doesn't it? Racing, it's like any sport when you're actually having to race. I mean, James, by the way, is a very good driver, but a racer. But you racing and the risks you take, And so I've had these funny moments. Like I did a lot out at Bondurant at one point, and we had the ACR Viper, and this is like 3 or 4 years ago. It's now not called Bondurant, is it? Called Radford. But I was giving these demo laps, and these guys, were able to go nearly as fast. So I had to like peg it just to show off. Yeah. And sometimes they're looking out the window. You're like, oh, I'm really doing a good job here. And you're just looking at it as though this is a virtuoso performance and all my skills. And you're like looking out the window because it's not that impressive. Yeah. It's tough to stand out.
Yeah, and that is when I phrased the question, I specifically picked like the GT3 because like GT3 class of racing has all the aids and all the stuff. And I'm not saying it's easy to drive one of those cars or whatever, but you switch into, let's say, prototypes or something with like no aids. And the gap suddenly, same drivers pretty much, just goes like,
vroomph. Yeah. And understanding high downforce, the commitment it takes to go through a corner with a high downforce car and just trusting it's going to do it. You need a degree of, you need your skill level goes up. But there are those freaks that are just brave. They're just brave. Yeah. And you go, oh my God, you could have done anything in life. You're just brave and / stupid. You go, God, you got no fear. I always had fear. These guys have no fear. But again, don't you think that we're entering this age, especially because of the amount of sim driving, because of watching these unreal crashes on TV that the Formula One drivers could have or IndyCar drivers could have.
Yeah.
That's a bit of a shake. Cleared from the medical department. It's great. But it's people, I think there's a generation of kids out there that don't think they could get killed in a race car. I think there's a lot that would think it's inconceivable. Because don't you just hit reset, right?
Boom, yeah.
It's gone, you know?
I had a really funny, I was at Spa with BAC driving a mono, and there was another driver there who had spent a lot of money on his home sim, like 20, 30K or something.
Nice.
And it was set up as like a GP2 sim or something. And we were talking about driving at Silverstone, and I was saying, I have a radical. And for me, it took a long time to do like a lot of the corners there. You're turning in under power and then lifting, which whereas in a road car, you're braking, I don't know, way back. And I was saying, psychologically, that took me a long time to build up to that. And he was like, it's just like, you know, in a GP2 car, it's just flat. And I was like, mate, you've never driven a GP2 car. He's like, yeah, but it's the same. Like, but there's a big difference between doing it on the sim.
He was actually
a really, really good driver. But doing it on the sim and in real life, like, you hit solid stuff, it's going to hurt.
It really is. I mean, that's a way bigger conversation, isn't it, about where this is all going in life. I mean, the sim stuff is incredible. I personally was not of the generation, there's no excuse, because I have friends that are so into it. I never transitioned to it actually being a reality-based comparison to driving. I still have it in the, it's a experience game version. I don't, that's probably why I don't drive them very well, because I haven't transitioned to, like, the conditions those test drivers must be in Formula One. When, you know, I don't think you'll get a job now. I don't think you'll get hired unless you could perform on the sim. Do you agree?
And
I mean, you won't go to Formula One unless you're a, I mean, didn't they say Brendan Hartley was so good on the sim? That's one of the main reasons that, you know, he obviously did really well in the race car for Porsche. But he was so good in the sim that was almost one of the main reasons he
got hired. Yeah, it's like Max.
Yeah?
Max Verstappen is really good in a sim. Same for Lando. But there was something recently, because I've done a bit of, well, it's actually, there's a sim behind me, but the, of like a reasonable amount of on track, not tons, but like reasonable amount of on track racing, and then also sim. And now, because I've got this at home, I do more of that than I do on track, cheaper, easier. You can do it in 20 minutes and then stop. But I try and like equate one to the other and sort of pick up a bit of both. But there was a company, I can't remember who did it. I think it might have been Gran Turismo or something. Someone basically came up with a driver, a sort of robo-driver type thing, whatever you call it, AI driver. And it ran iterations of a track. And it could sort of, you know, work out parameters and whatever and stay on the track. And it got to a point where it could do lap times that are just faster than anyone else, because it's done everything. But the thing that was really interesting to me is they talk to racing drivers about it and what this car was doing, and the driver was doing, and they go like, okay, initially. And then a couple of years later, we're on version 10 or something, and it would do stuff in certain corners that no one had ever thought of. And people go, oh, I wouldn't have tried that. And then they go out and do it, and they're like, oh no, it is faster. So it's there in not too long, we could get some real, like, really interesting sort of coaching type software that will run the models of the track you're driving at. And yeah, there'll be a bit of difference between real life and the thing, but it might suggest stuff that no one or no driver coach may have come across, or no one suggests you, and it could be faster, which is really interesting.
Genius, isn't it? And I it makes sense, because AI can do things on in a way that we just can't. I mean, I remember that takes you all the way back to in the pre-data world. I remember let's just say Brands Hatch at the hairpin, whatever, what's that called? Top hairpin, you know, turn two, whatever.
Druids, whatever.
Druids, whatever.
Is it Druids? Yeah.
Druids. there's many conversations about where the line should be.
Mm.
If you go on a wider radius, in any other vehicle, in anything else in the planet, you will go faster if you take the wider radius, right? It's physics. But we don't. We go on the inside unless it's wet, and then we go on the outside.
Yeah.
The AI would sort that out categorically.
And I would be really interested to know.
Yeah, the AI feedback would be that at 3,600 revs in second gear, but you have to be in third gear rather than second because otherwise it's too much, you know, sort of torque going through it. You could actually run the outside line and gain 0.2 of a second. We just, because as drivers, when we went in to do it, and you might have that idea, you go and try it. But because it's new, you don't react well. You go, oh, God, it's loaded up differently, and you'd lift off. But the AI wouldn't lift off. The AI knows you hold a constant throttle. You know, you're right. I mean, stuff that, of course, we think Formula One teams don't have that. If you know about, if you've said Gran Turismo do it, I bet that's what they have, right? Their simulation will tell them that you know, you should upshift here and take that. I mean, it's crazy. It is brilliant. But the one thing they can't do, the one thing AI cannot predict is us. So in a race, it cannot predict the shitty move that the guy in front pulls, right? Because it can only predict what another AI would do. This is my supposition, right? Because AI against AI would... they would have the same data, so they would respond in the same way. But humans, we're just, you know, retards sometimes, right? We'll just pull a move and we'll react. We'll see him coming and we'll block him. Even against the rules, we'll block him. Now, the AI driver will just hit you because he wouldn't be expecting that. So human weakness is, thank God, the only thing that'll keep us, you know, in behind the wheel.
And also, no one's interested in watching a bunch of AI cars go around. I think, I don't think so really, because it removes the key element. And I think the reason why, you know, lots of shows are interesting, why I find, you know, I like taking photos, cameras, it's people, it's a story. That's why we watch this stuff, really.
I mean, it totally is, in the same way that, I'm not saying I know anything about it, but in the same way there's like simulated anime porn, right? So maybe as some generation that's fun to watch, but it probably isn't to our generation because they're robot. It's animated, it's not real. But there is a group of people of, you know, generation that probably think that's hot. So we're heading down all sorts of weird roads on that.
And there's room for all of these things out there. It's very interesting. So you were talking, okay, let's wind back into a little bit of the racing. You raced for Corvette, you race Viper, and actually you pronounced the chassis company
Orica.
Is that Orica? I don't know. I've heard Orica, Orica, whatever. Anyway,
I always said Orica, but it's probably Orica, you know.
Whatever. But that car, I have done some photography for the Endurance Racing Legends, which do the Peter Auto events, of which there are some of the GT2 Vipers driving around. And that, for me, playing PlayStation games growing up, it was always in Gran Turismo and stuff like that, it's a cool car. But it's completely different to the road cars, isn't it?
That's the discussion. Disclaimer I had to make for the last 25 years is the Vipers, the road cars were so rudimentary. You know, they overheated, they just were so rough to handle. I mean, kind of in a affectionate way, I guess, if you were owner of one, and you got used to it. But the race car was fully prepared as an evolved as a modern day GT car. It was what Orica did to the chassis, and in combination with Chrysler, was incredible. I mean, we were dominant and massive horsepower. I mean, who would have thought you could have put, you know, a V10 front engined heavy engine like that in the front of that and still create a great race car? So lots of downforce. I mean, the car was so good to drive. And on Michelin's, we really had an advantage. And took Porsche a lot of time to catch up at that time. They didn't really have a contender for it. And, you know, So people say, oh, that was a bag of crap to drive. And you go, yeah, not the race car. The race car was very sophisticated, you know, combination of a carbon fiber and a roll cage. I mean, it was very quick. Yeah. Much nicer to, and high and fast. I mean, we were well into the 200, yeah, well over 200 on the straight at Le Mans, you know, whereas the prototypes were only doing like just about 200. But, you know, they had so much downforce and we would go past them on the straight, you know, amazing.
That must have been. And were they, when was this? This was like, I've got it up, 97,
6, 98? 7, 8, 9. Yeah,
9. Were they paddles or like a sequential stick?
No. Manual? Ended up with a sequential stick. But the first couple of years we had a gear stick, which was really 6-speed bolts, which was really difficult. The same as the Vipers, oddly enough, on the road, because the gear stick's sort of up a bit higher. So going from 5th to 6th would pinch your shoulder, you know. And so it's and of course, the consequence, if you got lazy for going 5th to 4th, would have been, you know, a 180-mile-an-hour lockup. So, you know, it was very conscious going into 6th gear, and that hurt your shoulder. At Le Mans, it was like, oh, my God, I've got to shift again. So you'd almost reverse your hand like that and push it across the box. Didn't have to be a fast shift. It was a sequential, old-fashioned, you know, it was good, cool for us at the time, sequential. There was something about a center-mounted sequential lever, though, that I've never really talked to other drivers. There was still a very physical, visceral experience to, bang, bang, you know, pushing it down, and pulling it back instead of just flicking things on a steering wheel. You know, you still had to take your hand off. Well, like you did in Formula cars for a long time, right? There was a little sequential lever to the right and you'd do it. So I don't know, there's something about balancing a car, timing your shift, you know, I think you're very engaged when you're doing that. The steering wheel is, you can't miss a shift. That's it.
Yeah.
Can't miss it.
Yeah.
So.
Moves nothing. With your hands, whatever. We're two hands same. On the wheel the entire time.
Yeah, we're all the same. Yeah.
It does. I had Darren Turner on the podcast a while back, and he was saying his favorite, I think the favorite car he'd raced was the DBR9, which was also a stick sequential in the middle.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you're doing, like you're saying, like so much. You're doing so much. You are really creating the lap time. You are in other cars, but like to put it all together, and I'm presuming, did the Vipers move around quite a lot?
Oh yeah, I mean, you think we had no ABS until maybe the last year we did. All that weight, if when you came in a little on an angle, the car would be like moving around, and I mean, it was well planted though. But you know, sometimes up towards 800 horsepower, so you know you had to control the power down. I mean, it's, you bring up an interesting point about, you know, like Darren said about you had to really control the car. Well, I think ABS is genius on road cars, but I'm not sure why we put it on race cars. I mean, I understand why Porsche would on the GT4 for the gentleman, you know, but you look at Daytona or Sebring and you've got the GTD cars up against the GT cars, you know, the main cars, and they're quicker than them under braking, and especially in the wet, they can slaughter them.
Yeah.
You know, they can slaughter a $20 million Corvette race program, can be outbraked by, you know, again, the urologist from Ojai in his GT4, right? Doesn't make sense. It's like madness. And being able to downshift and manually downshift, balance the car on the brake, heel and toe, without locking out the brakes in the wet, that made you a better driver. We wouldn't have seen those stunning drives from Senna and all those people if they hadn't been shifting gear in the wet. I mean, could Senna at Donington have gone around the outside of everybody in the rain in that non-championship race if it had been, the cars had all been the same under braking? I don't think so. I don't think we'd have missed moments of history.
That's a really interesting point, because it is, it's like we were talking about, you know, good people and truly great people. Like, if you don't give them the opportunity to showcase that level of skill, and like a modern GT3 car has got ABS and traction control, and like everyone's, you know, you just smash the pedal.
Yeah.
Just smash the pedal and it sorts the rest out. And like, there's so braking. I don't think I've ever raced with ABS. Maybe a little bit. I did Citroen C1 once. That's cool. That had ABS, and the ABS was pretty awful, but it made driving in the wet so much less sketchy. So much less sketchy.
Yeah, totally. It does. And you know, I mean, you can't go backwards with technology. I understand that. But I remember one of the guys, I did a BMW, Ray Hall Letterman Racing, Lanigan Racing. They bring out BMW communications here in California, in America. They bring out a lot of the old cars, and we go to Mid-Ohio. And they do like a couple of days at Mid-Ohio, and they invite journalists and things. And they have the, you know, that's the last time I drove the McLaren. They have a 96 FINA sponsored, you know, Le Mans F1 GTR. And so I go off in it, and I'm driving around, and it's just so sublime, you know, you know. And I remember I did a silly little YouTube video. I was doing something for GoPro, actually, so we filmed the whole thing. But I also had a helmet, my own helmet cam on, but it wouldn't see over the dash. It actually just looked at my feet. And all these kids, when I put it to YouTube, were like, "What's that new technique, man? That's really cool." It was heel and toe, obviously. And they had a journalist go out, and a young journalist, because, you know, if you work for a big magazine, you get the chance. Yeah. And they had to pull him in. Screaming revs, over revving it. They're like, "Okay, you're out." And then they talked about it, that a lot of the, obviously, you can teach these young drivers are so talented. It takes them 6 minutes to learn how to heel and toe and do everything, you know. But the junior factory drivers have never driven a manual car.
Yeah.
So they can't drive the museum cars.
Yeah.
Because they've never heel and toed. You cannot drive a historic sports car or Indy car or Formula One car if you can't heel it down, if you can't heel and toe, because they've never done it, you know. It's, so you need,
it's quite funny training. Seeing some of these drivers do it, because and obviously that I think some of them, they're like, "Oh, hang on a minute, I'm going to drive a historic Ferrari or whatever, I better go and get some practice in." But there's a big difference between getting a bit of practice in and all your racing your entire life being in a manual car. Like, that's a complete different wealth of knowledge. And I'm sure, well, I don't know, you're saying this journalist went out in the F1 GTR. I'm sure he was, like, probably okay.
He's probably a pretty good darn driver, yeah.
Probably pretty good, but, like, that's not the same.
No. No, you just got the wrong skill set. It's like, I mean, honestly, we grew up, anyone, I mean, you know, think of the guys that, you could, if you had to jump in a car and drive it fast, and you had five laps, cold start, never seen the cars before, and you put Martin Brundle and Jonathan Palmer and, you know, to any of that era, right? Johnny, you know, Perry McCarthy, all the old guys, and Johnny Herbert and everyone, and then all the way through to DC and those guys, we just go and do it. Whereas if you put this up against Lando and all those guys, it'll take them a couple of laps to work out, why are they braking so late? How are they balancing the car? I really think it would, you know, because it's like riding a bike. We know that's all we knew for all those years.
Yeah.
But, you know, in the end, talent is, I really believe talent's talent. So it's just, you adapt to the technology, right? These guys are freaking amazing at a higher level than any other driver has ever been, because of the way they know nothing else, right?
Yeah. Everyone loves to bash like an F1 driver for not being able to drift or something, which used to be a thing, I think, like 10 years ago. And now they've all gone, okay, well, I feel like we should probably go and learn to do that. And then, funnily enough, they have unbelievable car control, unbelievable connection to the car. They're going to pick this stuff up pretty damn quickly.
So, let alone the fact that they're going to practice it 3,000 times before they ever get in the real car, back to your sim thing. You know what I mean? It's like,
Yes,
that's it. It was very interesting. I was at a BMW revealed their new LMDH V8 hybrid GTP car at the Peterson on Thursday last week. And Colton Herter was there. It was great chatting with him, with his dad, Brian Herter. Obviously, the whole thing about the super license and stuff. But I didn't talk about it. I just said, as someone that has never done it, what was it like when you jumped in the, can you hear me all right? I just hit something by accident. Shoot. When you're in a Formula One car, just what's that like? And he went, it's the power. The way they come off corners is unbelievable. And the amount you have to deal with on a lap. You have so many controls on everything that we can't even imagine it. You know what I mean? It's like, as he said, a 10-stop control with 10 options on each stop with 30 options in the next menu. And you're doing that driving around Spa.
It's in the wet. With other cars around you, that's like,
and you're changing, it looks so simple. Diff settings between corners, you're changing. Yeah. I mean, I remember it was outrageous. I remember the first time I learned that, the Formula One drivers would change the brake bias between corners. That seemed a lot. Now they're changing all sorts of stuff. It's pretty wild.
It is mental, and it's impossible to get your head around. It's another one of those things where I think some people look at Formula One drivers and go, that just looks easy. And the modern cars do look so smooth when you drive them, which looks easy, but they're going so fast. They're on the edge. You can't be any more on the edge than they're on. They're literally going as fast as you can go in those cars. And they're doing these 50 million things at the same time. And occasionally someone will scream in from the pits being like, oh, can you just do this? And the driver will go, can you not talk to me mid-corner
No wonder
at 160 miles an hour, please?
and also, isn't that funny, in the last Grand Prix, which team was it? And even the announcers were like, I think they're just bullshitting now. It's like, let's go to option F. Plan G. I mean, I can't. I mean, honestly, I struggled to log into this. I mean, how the fuck is it? Option G? Shit, you got, Hamilton up your ass, and you're like, can't remember what plan C was, It is wild.
Exactly.
Definitely wild. But it makes for good entertainment. So, yeah, it's a sport. We love it.
It is very cool. So, you did a bunch of racing, and then did you move to the States mid that? Yeah.
No, I actually, at the end of the Viper years, end of 99, I got headhunted by Corvette, launching their, world sports car program, to go and race for them. And I knew the Viper program was wrapping up. It might have one more year, but I knew the program was winding down. So, I mean, to get asked to go and join Corvette was incredible. So next year I was at Daytona, and that was the year that a GT car won overall, the Viper won overall. But can you imagine, it was my old car and my new car. The Viper was wounded, and Ron Fellows was catching him by like 12 seconds a lap. And we lost the race by 3.2 seconds. And I mean, we just needed another lap. We need another quarter of a mile and we'd have won it. But I'm like, no, that was the car I just left. And now it's just won the Rolex 24 at Daytona. I'd have had the watch. So that was second there. And then we podiumed at, we DNF'd at Sebring, and for whatever reasons, still never really found out that program I didn't get continued at the end of that year. It wasn't performance based. I think it was personality based, and there's politics. And so then I went off into other forms of GT racing, equivalent to like British, let's say, touring car championship or whatever over here. But the TV started to evolve, and once that started, I knew I wanted to be really good at TV.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story.
In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
And one thing that I know a lot of the YouTubers I know, and it's very obvious when you watch someone on a TV program, did you sort of develop a TV persona or like a, did you go, you know, I need to ramp up when I'm on TV or anything like that?
Well, I mean, I give people advice when they say, how shall I do even a speech? You know what I mean? To someone, I say, I've got to say that as ourselves, we're a little boring. I don't care who you are, you know, TV or presenting requires a 10% amplification of who you are. If you go 40%, then you're going to look like a dick, right? But, you know, just you can't be just yourself. If you know, imagine getting up on stage. Imagine DC and Jensen at the Formula One going, no, that was great. That was a good race. Yeah, I mean, you know, I was having a coffee and, I mean, it was good. You know, it was nice and Max did all right, didn't he? You know, you go, oh, that's boring. You need them to be like this a bit. So, yeah, you definitely do. But for me, I like being funny. I enjoy like almost messing it up. And, you know, someone once said to me, if you're not in danger of almost getting fired every time you do TV, then you're not really doing it right. And so I embrace that. I've really found a niche. I think, though, the problem was is that when IMSA went from Fox Sports to NBC, NBC is a much more conservative company, believe it or not, than Fox Sports. And I just didn't fit their mold. I mean, you know, saying the things I said and being the way I am, it just didn't really fit. So, and weirdly enough, it's just the bizarre thing of the world we live in. We're evolving as humans, and yet we're regressing in terms of what's permitted. You know, in France, when I was 5 years old, there's boobs on billboards, right? You know what I mean? And now it's like we're almost going puritanical with some of this crap. It's very weird. No grid girls, right? Tell that to the girls that don't work on the grid anymore who've lost their jobs. I mean, you know what I mean? We go into this weird place. Don't need to get into it. But that's why the web really opened up for me. And I don't have a personal following that I think maybe I should, but I work for a lot of brands and do a lot of work like that. But with IMSA doing that, that's what allowed us to start the talk show, which was me and another guy called Tommy Kendall, who's a Hall of Fame British American driver, and a producer called Jason Jacobson, who was with IMSA and NASCAR Productions. And we left, and I said, I've always wanted a chat show. So now I have a chat show.
Yeah.
And, you know, within reason, you can't quite say what you want when you're sponsored by a big brand like Michelin, as we were. But you can certainly say a lot more than they can on TV. And I think the fans respond to that.
Yeah, and having your own show. Like that, it's my favorite thing about this podcast, for example. Like, it's my podcast. Occasionally, early days, people would be like, oh, you can't talk about that because of whatever. Yeah, they just have some opinion about
totally.
You know, this. I think someone was like, yeah, we don't want to hear about you, like about me. I was like, fine, okay,
right.
Whatever. But at the same time, it is my podcast. I can say whatever I like. I can ask whatever I like.
I do the same thing. Yeah. And you guide it. I mean, I remember you do it off your... It's your personality. It's my personality. It's the mix. It's how you get good interviews. It's how you chat with people. But I remember it's Jay Leno, when I did a lot of work for him when I came over to LA. That's what brought me to LA from Florida. And, you know, people would make heinous posts about him or letters. And he's like, what do you think? I have 17 million viewers a night, you know, on a big night. You think if I have 1,000 letters telling NBC that I'm shit and I should change it, doesn't add up. You don't change for one person, or if you have 17 million people. He said, well, I wouldn't even be on TV, would I? You know, and so you just keep doing your own thing and do it your own way. And the, it's sort of that's I've got to believe in the long play that that my style is more genuine and authentic than what they can do on TV.
Yeah, that point there about, you know, ignoring the thousand letters or whatever, we seem to have lost that. No, I don't. Not necessarily individuals, but companies and media companies and all these sorts of things. You know, you get five comments on Twitter.
Yeah.
So what?
And they change. Right. I do work for, it was something with Haggerty we did at an event, and they're like, I was hosting something for them because, you know, they're just doing so well right now. And they went, we need to kind of change the format a little bit because there's, there were people saying that it wasn't enough cars and it was too much of you and Tommy. And so then Jason went back and looked through every comment. And it's one guy with 96 followers in Chicago.
Yeah.
That's it. So, I mean, I hate to say it, mate. Don't watch. That's it. You know, I'm not going to change it for you.
Don't like it. Don't watch.
Don't like it. Yeah. And it's the old thing, you know, bad news travels well. Nine times faster than good news. People love to talk shit rather than that. So, I mean, I definitely think in today's world, you know, to report on things with a candid and open way is it really important? But as we know, the mainstream media doesn't allow that, and so I think that's where podcasts have become the new form of news. You know, Joe Rogan is the form of news here in America for most of us, right? Because he'll just report on things, and they tried to take him down, but they couldn't.
That was interesting.
That was very interesting. And, you know, there's other examples of that. And in sport, you know, I remember once the guy who was running IndyCar at the time called me in and said, I've met him at a dinner, and he came from the rodeo world or whatever. And he was quite an interesting choice to run the company at the time. Didn't last long. But he was like, what do you think of it? And I go, it isn't presented right. I said, let's just imagine Sean White, because it was massive at the time, you know, is in the half pipe at the Olympics. Let's forget the Olympics, just at whatever event. And he's doing this extraordinary triple flip 20 feet above the lip of the half pipe. And then you cut to three guys in blazers with gold buttons standing there with bad shoes in the snow. You go, what the fuck? What?
It just
doesn't make sense. So why are you reporting on the sexy men and women doing these sports that, you know, they drive fast, they do everything they want to do. And we have to put reports on them like they're accountants. You know, it's not real life. We don't all live like that. So so I'm glad that there's outlets that showcase, the like yourself, like what I do, that showcase the reality of them.
Yeah, 100%. And I think it's why loads of these shows, even whether it's like a thing that's I don't watch much, but I could see why you might, is like people that live stream an event, a match, whatever, and then do their own commentary over whatever it is, football, Le Mans, whatever. Yeah. But it's like a bunch of mates, and it's they're saying the stuff that the people behind, you know, on the sofa are saying to each other, and they're like, "Oh, this is amazing! This is what we want to hear."
Yeah, I mean, I've thought about doing that for years with IMSA, and you know, sitting Tommy, me, Paul Tracy, other people, Patrick Dempsey calling it, and it's just like, what the fuck were they doing that for? You know, what I mean, it's real, right? But then I think it'd be nice if you had a lot of money in the bank and you could just do shit like that because it was fun.
True.
You know, in reality, you need to have some money behind you so you can do it and not care about sponsors. And then if you did it, I think you'd get sponsors, you know?
Yeah. Or it's been your sort of journey. You've started off as this, it was a side thing you did, and it's grown to a size where people can't ignore you anymore. Like Joe Rogan, he's hit such a size and all that. stuff that came out. And I take pretty much everything that comes out of the media nowadays with a pinch of salt of like, oh, you know, so-and-so said this, so-and-so said that. And I'm like, yeah, but do we have the context? Do we have the full situation?
And we don't research it, and we don't. You know, that is still why there's no sport remains relatively pure in its media reporting, because there's no advantage commercially to distorting the facts, right, of why Max is so fast or whatever. And the teams might distort it, and Ferrari might lie a bit about, or, you know, or we our strategy would have worked if no one else was on the track. You know, it's sort of, I mean, I understand why big money corporations have to defend their position, but as far as the drivers and the way you, all of us can report, and I think we're allowed to be pretty pure on it.
Yeah, but not when it comes at the end of the day, you've got to finish first.
Not when it comes to big pharma and politics, that's all bullshit. So, you know.
Yeah, so I think one of the funny ones was like, what was it, F1 last, end of last season? Was it last season? Was it even the before? With the whole Max, Lewis kerfuffle, blah, 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 blah. And you had so many people, this is a classic like social media type thing. Everyone came out and was like, a section of people, I'm never watching this again, blah, 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 blah. This is awful. And it was all the stuff that was like not on track. But then this year has had the greatest viewing figures ever because of all this drama. Everyone's like, ooh, what's this? What's going on?
Yeah, I mean, Drive to Survive has changed the 100%. Face of sports car, of Formula One
sports.
Perception of sports, of all sports. You're right. It's a great way of putting it. I mean, people here have never watched Formula One. Formula One struggled to make it in the American market. And now we're having three races next year? That's outrageous. I mean, three races. You couldn't get to the Miami Grand Prix this year. You could not physically. I mean, if you weren't prepared to spend $5,000 and upwards on a ticket, you couldn't go. It's unbelievable. It shows that the right social, you know, the right presentation of the people and the drivers, and I mean, it's amazing. So yeah, I mean, it's great. So I don't think it would work in sports cars. I mean, you know, it's like Top Gear, right? Top Gear was genius and brilliant, and all the other versions of it, America or otherwise, are just crap imitations. It's like a bad tribute band. Yeah. You know, you watch those three because they're great.
Yeah.
And it's a bit like that with Formula One. Formula One set the bar. That's it. Everyone else from is trying to do their own shows.
Advertising. From an advertising point of view and stuff, I've heard it a few times. They basically go, yeah, so in car racing, there's Formula One, which is pretty much the only one worth doing if you're a big company. Mm-hmm. And then there's no point in doing any of the others in terms of sponsorship. Like, yes, you might have a vested interest or whatever, but in terms of hitting people and eyeballs, Formula One is just like, woof, the top.
Totally. Totally. It's remarkable. It's funny, you know, I have a stunt coordinator for Ford versus Ferrari sent me a shirt. He was on my show a while back, and Robert Nagel, and he sent me it was a really nice shirt. The T-shirt's got Ford versus Ferrari graphics on and everything. Even I was wearing it yesterday, and even the guy in the store was like, oh, I love the shirt. That movie, for example, did more to tell people, even my dad, Sierra, people, and it's certainly, you know, 10 years a lot more than 10, 1966, a lot more than that. You know, I was born a couple of years later, but 20 years before I went there, show people what that race is all about. People are like, oh, I get it now. I get what Le Mans about. I didn't realize what it was involved. And you're like, the power of pop culture is amazing, you know. It's just, it's great when something comes out that really does promote our sport. There is a new series. There's a new movie that's going to come out. They're about to embark on it. And I know it's, they put it in the, it was in the media the other day. So I'm sure most of the details are out, but you know, it's the story of kid Jan Marlborough, you know, his story basically with the Nissan Academy going to Le Mans. Boom. I mean, what an inspirational story. It's been waiting to be made, right? Because that is a genuine rags to riches story. I mean, unbelievable. And kills someone on the way in a crowd, you know, and does he do it? Should he carry on? I mean, it's just, I think it'll be hugely popular. Wish I was involved. Yeah. But, you know, I love the story.
Very so cool. And a real marker of these shows, whether it's Drive to Survive or Top Gear, and all the ones that really sort of stand out, that break the mold, is when your relative or your friend who's not interested in cars or whatever goes, yeah, I watched that. It's quite fun.
Yeah.
Well, I enjoy it.
I get it. I like it. Especially when I think it, and those were really responsible for a lot of these really talented girls that are getting into racing. Because I've got to say, when I was young, there was one, I wonder what happened to Emily. She was racing against us in Formula Ford. I was meant to look on in Facebook and see if she was around. I've got to find her last name. But she was the only girl in my first 3 years of racing I ever saw. And now it's through karting and everything. And I think especially with the way society is, you've got a lot more chance. My only comment would be, if you're good, you're good. You should have a chance of a drive. If you're bad, just because of gender or persuasion or color, I think you shouldn't, why would you have a, racing, eventually you're going to look like you're not going to look good enough, right? It's like, doesn't matter what you're from. If you're on a tennis court, eventually you're not going to look good enough up against someone else. And, but the fact is, if you get the opportunity, and I'm really glad that so many different people are getting the opportunity, in the end, they still got to perform. That's all we care about,
Yeah, I think we've seen it quite a lot in sort of sports car racing with, are they called the Iron Dams?
I think something like that.
Who were smashing it in GT cars. And that sort of thing, like a female-only team, and you might get some people like, oh, whatever, regardless. Like, it's amazing. And I think there's so much opportunity for, well, to be honest, a female-only team are going to be able to get sponsors that men cannot get. And they can get all the other ones as well. But they might be able to bring other brands, more into eyeballs into our sport, which 100%. Is great for everyone.
Yeah. It's anything that lifts, say a rising tide lifts all boats, and anything that brings more people and more awareness. I remember Elio Castroneves sent, he's a buddy, saying about Danica, she's not the highest paid IndyCar driver. She's the highest earning IndyCar driver at the time because of all of her endorsements and what she brought to it. And every one of them were like, yeah, this is great. We don't get on the cover of Sports Illustrated.
Yeah.
We don't get Maxim covers. More people know about us. So, anything to keep our sport going, because I do think we're going to enter into a little bit more of a tougher era with electrification and all that. I think it's not, it's a long way off before we're not driving noisy racing cars, because the option is not that fun, is it?
It comes up every now and then, and I don't particularly talk about Formula One too much, but Formula One, everyone complains the engines need to change because of et cetera, et cetera. And I understand from a manufacturer point of view, from a marketing, how you might want to skew things, but that's not really what we've done in the last, 20 years in Formula One. It's the circus that follows Formula One. That is the only thing that matters in terms of eco credentials. They should all have 15,000 RPM, V8s, V12s, because the fuel they use is just inconsequential versus the trucks that are getting flown across the world.
I still think they say, this statistic has been around for 20 years, but I think the entire season of Formula One, or maybe even global motorsports, uses the same gas as 1747 London Miami.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Let's just say it's 200,000 gallons. I don't know. But
someone can
prove it, right? It's just, it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. How much gas does the US president's cavalcade use when it lands in another country with, 50 vehicles it brings in and stuff? Really? No, it's all perception, isn't it? And everything's perception and Formula E, you know, everyone did Formula E just long enough to hit their social credit yeah. score. So now they can go back into LMD, create an LMDH, you know. And it's really impressive how those cars can go from 0 to 60 on the electric engine before they kick in a V8.
Yes.
I'm being slightly sarcastic. I mean, it's magnificent that it powers them off. And, of course, you can distribute electric power anywhere you want, right? So it can go to the right wheel, it can go to the left wheel. It can. I mean, it's pretty genius. I mean, as an engineer, it must be what a fabulous tool to have. Is instant torque to be applied where you want it in the car at any
direction?
I mean, it's like the Holy Grail. So that's why these cars, I've got to tell you, I'm very excited for next year. I think we're in my opinion, in for the globally, the heyday of sports car racing in its modern form, and could last 3 years, could last 5 years, as long as it can. We know it's on a cycle. It always is in sports cars. Formula One never seems to have the cycle, you know, this does, sports cars do, and because of the manufacturers. And we're in for this undeniable heyday with the 100th of Le Mans next year.
Yeah.
I mean, the number of manufacturers that are grasp hold of the LMDH GTP rules, it's just stunning. Lamborghini, I mean, it's going to be
insane.
Great. It's insane.
Insane.
So we're in for something really special. And, you know, I hope, you know, we're there with the talk show sort of right there watching it and, you know, seeing it all. Technology to us as fans is there are fans that love the technology, but on-track action is not determined by technology. It's only ruined normally by too much technology. Yeah. Back to the thing, if you, you know, have steel brakes, not carbon brakes, you increase the braking distances. If you know, I mean, anything that can be done, less downforce, harder to overtake. So, I mean, there's the technology has stunted a lot of our ability to watch great racing. But technology overcomes the regulations, right? In Formula One, they go and put the groove in the middle of the tire or whatever that was, and they're still going faster within like 2 test days because they're so freaking brilliant and so many resources. They just overcome. So, well, you better ask me your 5 questions.
Yeah, we should.
Or did we already answer them?
We should. No. Do you have a most memorable driving trip or journey?
Yeah. Can it be? Okay, it's two parts. This Dad used to tell us when he raced for Ferrari, he was with, he had a 275 GTB. No seats, you know, only a parcel shelf in the back. My sister and I, both under the age of 3 years old, wrapped in ski jackets because there were no car seats back then. And my mum is in the front, asleep in the front, and in this beautiful GT Ferrari heading down to Modena. He said on the Autostrada, he did 175 miles an hour. And he just sat there with fall asleep, thinking this is what a world. Anyway, I always grew up with that story. Through my buddy Russ Malkin, when we were in my early 20s, we used to do this thing called London to Venice Orient Express Challenge. And it was ahead, before they started doing all the cannonballs and all these things, you know, all those bull runs and stuff. We'd drive from London, Victoria to Venice without using a highway, flat the fuck out. I mean, it was using French villages as apexes in the night. And anyway, there was a guy on this called Mike Lake who was into comics and comic business, long hair, kind of funny looking guy, really nice. He had a Daytona, same as Dad, all those years before. And I told him this story and he said, well, let's retrace the route back to England. And so after the event was over, I drove back with him and we did like smooth as silk, GT, original GT cars, really, grand touring and 175 miles an hour on the Autostrada. And I remember thinking, this is like me retracing the steps. And Dad was right. This car will do it. So it was just, to me, that will always stand out as a very memorable drive.
That is super cool. We've definitely lost a lot now with modern GT cars, 812, whatever, all that sort of stuff. They're comfortable doing like 150 all day long, but you just can't do it now.
Can't
sit at like 80.
No, I know.
It's no fun, is it?
It's just no fun.
So you got then got to drive all the stuff again.
You got to drive all the
stuff.
It's
a bit more sketchy.
Yeah, that's why I think everyone loves it. You know, the connection.
Yeah. If you could drive one car, you can only drive one car for the rest of your life, and then you have something super cheap on the side. So you got one, pick whatever, and then you got something cheap on the side that fills family duties or whatever. So, and I normally say like £500, so it's like a proper, well, with inflation, let's say 1,000.
I would. That is a really difficult question, isn't it? Because immediately you go, well, how much money do I have to spend? Is it, you know, but you're right. If I had one car for the rest of my life, I'd love to say a 911 turbo. I would. I'd love to say that. But in reality, if I had to live in a car apocalyptically and drive anywhere, it would be a Range Rover. I think because you're a bit fucked, aren't you, in your 911 turbo when the roads are stopped and you can't get across. What are you going to do? You can't get up the curb. Can't drive anywhere. I can't, you know what I mean? So it's like, I can't take the family when they're older in it.
Yeah, that's true.
I can't do anything in it. So, ooh. So.
But you could have like a Passat or something on the side.
I could have a Passat on the side. I could have a real old shit, a Zuzu or something, couldn't I? To get out. Mm. Okay, I would have I'd probably go to a Ferrari. I probably would. I'd probably go with, I mean, money notwithstanding, I mean, like a Lusso or something, because I think they're so beautiful. Ferrari Lusso, elegant, beautiful, stylish. You'd look good. It feels good. That'd be me.
Yeah, tick. What do you think is the most undervalued car at the moment?
At the moment?
It's tricky in today's market.
Oh, that's a real tough one, isn't it? I mean, it's so difficult because there's no such thing as a bad car now. You know, even, you know, look at the cars that Hyundai are bringing out and Kia. I mean, unbelievable cars that you drive and you go, oh my God, this does everything other than emotionally connect to me. But, you know, it does everything. Oh, okay. A car that is underrated. I mean, in a way, I'm going to go back to, it's so funny. I'll go back to my Range Rover. Range Rover. You know, you live in a place like LA and Range Rovers, you know, you almost need to spray mud on the side so you look like you use it properly. But I'll go back to the fact that if you take a full-fledged Range Rover, you could do 140 miles an hour on the highway, you could probably, whatever they do, you could climb mountains, you could go across rivers, you could literally go anywhere on the face of the planet in one of those and also go to the fanciest restaurant. Yeah. I don't think there's another big. So I think they've lost that. I think they don't want to lose that in their marketing. But, you know, the average person that buys one doesn't ever, ever, ever use its capabilities, and the Range Rover still can do it.
But it still sort of has to have it, doesn't it? Like you said, it's got to have that. It could do it. It's like when people are buying supercars now. They want to see Chris Harris, yourself, someone sliding it around, ragging it on the racetrack, and then they'll just drive, you know, to the shops and back. But they're like, but it could do a really fast Nürburgring time or something. Yeah. They want it in the back.
They want it in the back, and that's why, you know. So I still rate them very, very highly. It's probably a crap answer, but that's what I'll go with.
That's all right. What is the most interesting car to you at the moment? What are you Googling, looking up, going, ooh?
Ooh, that's interesting. You know, I'm kind of intrigued. I've driven very few electric cars, but we were trying to launch a show called Electric Talk under our brand. Mm-hmm. Sort of bringing two ex-car, you know, racers, champions that are finding out all about electric cars. And so I've been doing quite a lot of research. And, you know, you look at these Lucids and the VinFasts and the, you know, really unbelievable. But as even I'm talking to one of the guys that was in that world, you know, the barrier to entry on electric is actually very low because you buy all the technology in. It's all modular. You buy it and then come up with, oh, no, I launched the new DeLorean. At Pebble Beach, DeLorean is back, and I launched their new car, revealed it, Alpha 5. Really, you know, doors open up. It's cool as shit. But Yeah. So in a way, I'm looking at that, but I do get drawn to all the sexy stuff, you know, like, you know, the Ferrari, you know, I did stuff with Ferrari with the Roma, but I tell you, okay, the car that I most recently looked up, I'm going to butcher this, the new Ferrari SUV, which is not an SUV, it's a sports car, and they're coming out with it. Was it called the...
Something like that.
Yeah. I mean, we should get this right for people. Purasang. So anyway,
it's Purasang, but I don't know how you say it.
It's going to have extraordinary levels of performance, and typically being Ferrari, they're saying, you know, it's not an SUV, it's a Ferrari sports car. It's what we make.
What are you talking about?
And it's, but I think that's going to be very exciting. I mean, I remember when the BMW X, I'm a massive BMW X5, X6 M fan, yeah. And they're coming out with a new X5 M, I think. And yeah, I remember when I heard that was $130,000 at the time. I'm like, what lunatic would spend that on an SUV? And then you had the Urus that's $180,000 to $200,000. And then, you know, we've got the, you know, you've got the Aston Martin, which is divine, you know, the SUV. That's just sublime to drive. So I'm intrigued, right? These levels of performance being pushed in a car, you get four people, a dog and a Starbucks. It's
mind-numbing. It is completely mad. It's just completely bonkers, but kind of cool. And it's got a V12, which puts it above any of the others.
I'm into it. That's the last car I Google searched to find out about. Mm.
Yeah. Right. Final question. 5-car garage, unlimited value.
1995 Le Mans, Harrods Le Mans car would be in there, a GTR. Nice. Definitely have that. I'd have a Daytona because I'd need that. 275 GTB, you know, Daytona. I'd have an early 911. I'd like a 70s RS, early 70s RS, just because I love them. I don't know, like a 72 RS, probably, you know, just in orange if I could have it. I think that'd be pretty nice. And that lovely kind of orange that they did the 70s cars.
Yeah.
I would have a new 911 turbo because I drove it the other day and I thought, okay, this is me, my cup of tea, totally. I just loved it. You know, I'd have the Aston Martin SUV. That's what I'd have.
And would you have the 707? That's the light. Yeah. Have you driven that
absolutely.
One?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's, why not? I haven't driven it, but yeah, let's upgrade me to that. I think I'd be pretty happy that way. That would be a good garage.
I think you'd have a pretty good setup there.
I really would. Because, you know, old cars are wonderful, but like it was 110 here 2 weeks ago, 112, which I don't need. It was 46 degrees, 48 degrees, 45, hot. 46. Hot. And my friends in there, classic cars, you know, you see them, it's like, right now I saw one this morning, guys driving along this old Jag, windows open. I'm thinking, he feels like a god. It's 80 degrees. It's just cool. But at 110, the cars stop. They don't work. You know, I basically blow up my girlfriend's 996, you know, because the almost oil pissing out of it when it was 110 degrees. They can't handle it. They can't, you know, nowhere in Germany did they visualize 110 degrees. So old cars are cool, but not
cool enough sometimes.
Yeah, not cool enough.
Okay, I've got one more question actually that I've just thought of, and it's a bit left field because I know you like taking photos. One camera body, one lens.
Oh, okay. I'll always be with Leica. I love Leica cameras. I would have my M10, which is over there. My M10, which is the digital version of their original film camera, with a 50 millimeter Summerlux lens, which is what I have. Love the 50 millimeter lens. But I'll tell you what I'm using at the moment is this Q2.
I've got one of them.
Do you like the Q2?
I've got the same one as you. And I love it. I use it all the time.
I've got to say, maybe the best all-round camera in the world. I mean, because like, you know, you're probably the same as me. You know, the trouble with the rangefinder is that I have to focus it, you know, when someone's there. And I do love that challenge. But when you're outside, you know, I was doing this thing. I took a photograph, put it up on my site, Leica Racer, on my Instagram. And, you know, Bobby Rahal just pointed at me, snap shot. You can't do that with a rangefinder.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm kind of in love with this a lot right now.
Yeah, for sure. I got that Q2, the whatever it is, reporter edition, fairly recently. And my problem is the autofocus. Like if something's moving, not so good. But for ages, I can't hack the rangefinder thing. Like manually focusing like that is, I find it impossible. Mainly because I shoot cars. So like
you need that. You need. I shoot people mainly. You know what I mean?
But yeah.
And I mean, I have the SL2 with a 50 lens on it, and I love that camera, but it doesn't emotionally connect to me as much as my M10.
Yeah.
And this, even this
there's
Q2,
something about it. Like also the specifically the Leicas. I've never really. I would say up until I've owned the Q2. And that's probably really the only one that I don't know. I like the SLs and stuff like that, but it didn't connect to me. Like I've got a Sony, what's this one? A74.
Yeah.
Phenomenal. But like, it's a tool. It's 100% a tool to me. I don't go like, I wouldn't just sit and like look at it, but like I pick up my Q2 and I'm just like playing with how the battery goes in, goes back out. And I'm like, it's really weird.
Simplifies it. It's got a very, and you know, there's something, totally name dropping here, but I went to a Leica event at the Leica Store LA on Wednesday. My girlfriend got tickets to it, and Seal is a photographer, and he had an exhibition, and he was there. And she and I met at Rennsport when he was singing for 5 years ago. He was the performer, and so he didn't know. You know, I was like, "Oh, just so you know, you're reason we're together." And then we got talking about the cameras and things, and he's a super nice guy, and I was saying how we're talking about the why Leica compared to bigger cameras, you know, like the big Nikons, like the big Canons and Sonys and stuff. And this just, people just, you just can get right in their face. They still, it's fully digital, by the way. You can do it to your app, people, you know, and take the picture straight off it. But it gives you an accessibility in that old school way. And he agreed. He said, you know, I said, your predecessors, you know, the Rolling Stones, people like that. That's why we have these incredible pictures, because they would be backstage with their rangefinder or whatever it was. And there was no threat to it. They'd, you know, take photographs. Now we come in with those massive big lenses and
about
people
to pull
go,
one out, just like,
suddenly they're terrified of you, but you get in with this little Q2 far away. I resisted it. And now I've got it, and I'm dramatically impressed.
It's significantly altered. Like, I don't take pictures of people that often, and having that camera, especially it's 28 and you can sort of crop down a bit and whatever, but like, you've got to get in people's faces. And like, I generally avoid that with photography, but I'm now like, okay, this, I basically use this for travel and people and stuff like that. So I've got to, like,
I think you'll find that you will have your big camera. And you'll have this, like, I know some top motorsport photographers that will, this is what they have on their shoulder. You know, they're right there for the close-up. It's like having a knife. You can't, it's like having a pistol as opposed to an AK-4, you know, AR, right? You need a, I don't know much about shooting, but I imagine that you use a pistol up close rather than a bloody big machine gun, right? So that's what it is. Yeah, fantastic.
Yeah, and I've found that straight away. Like, I can use that camera alongside a bigger one for work, for whatever. And previously I had a Fuji X100V that's over there. And that just, it was like great. It's actually better autofocus and stuff like that. But the final image quality, just sharpness, resolution, the stuff, it's just not the same. And as soon as I started shooting with the Q2, I was like, oh, okay, I can use this. And I now will just get in the car or walk around with that. And I don't worry about having another camera with me or whatever.
No,
just
perfect.
Deal with it.
I mean, that's kind of, you know, bit of a shameless plug, you know. But I launched this Life with Legends podcast, and I put it on Patreon, and then I took it off because I realized that to do the Patreon route's tough going. I mean, you know, another subscription, you know, for people like you and I, we I thought it would make sense. Imagine you had 1,000 people spending $4 a month. That's going to be $4,000. It was easy math, right? How can I not get 1,000 people? You know, yeah. And then you realize, like Matt Farah, Smoking Tire, amazing journalist, media yeah. guy over here. Matt has 1 million people on his YouTube channel, yeah. and he has 680 people on Patreon.
Yeah.
So
okay.
ratio wise, it proves to me that you're pushing a square brick up a hill. So I took it down. I'm actually just relaunching it all now across all podcasts, but I couple it with my portrait photography. So I, I'm seeing Mario Andretti on Wednesday. I'm getting all the old guys and I do a sit down and take their portrait as well. And I use the SL2 and I'm going to use this just because I think I can get two different types of shots out of it.
That's a really cool way of doing it. Like, for having some kind of visuals alongside an audio podcast everyone wants video now and it like blah, 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 blah. But like if you can shoot some photos at the same time.
And I love it. And actually they kind of respond. And then I do these beautiful prints. You can actually, you can't see it. Stephanie Hansen over there. There he is. You can't see it. There he is. It's Stephen down the bottom. See? So I get them signed. I only do 24 prints of each signed where I can. It makes it a much more expensive and time laborious process. But, I'm very proud of it. And so that's lifewithlegends.com.
Yeah, so go check it out. What's your favorite platform in terms of creating and putting out media? Not from like an ease of use, but as in like that you actually genuinely, what's the one that you resonates with you the most, that you like doing the most?
I really enjoy Instagram and I wish I had more success on Instagram because I would commit to it more. And I like doing small video. I if you look at Justin Bell TV, like all my posts are actual videos. And I still go through that sort of depression that you get, like, what do you call it? Not depression. It's almost like not FOMO, but you're like incredulous that what? I look at other people's thing and I go, hold on a second, I'm driving Stirling Moss in a SLR 300 Mercedes and I've got 1,500 views. Meanwhile, someone else is showing, Shmi is showing the trunk of a Ford Capri and gets 3 million views. I'm like, what the fuck is going on? You know, I don't get it. So, I wish, I don't know, you've got to persevere, but I mean, I think for me, you've got to, I'm going to be unapologetic about trying to keep a high standard of what I do. And so I'll put it to my website, which I've just launched, Life of Legends, and I'll sell these pictures. And if I don't, I have a lot of really nice pictures and I've got great interviews, right?
Yeah. Like if you're really happy with the stuff you're doing, and I've over the years have really swayed to try and fit into what's right at the time, and I'm actually quite enjoying making some little videos at the moment, but from a photography point of view and stuff, and I kind of just got to a point now where I'm like, I'm going to post the stuff that I want to post and as much as I can. And if I start deviating from that, if I look at the things I've done and I'm not happy with it, like, what are you doing?
Yeah. There's only JWW and at some point, authenticity, I'm not saying they're not authentic, of course they are, but I mean, it's people like me doing what I do, it pays off. I mean, I do like to, obviously, real TV is amazing. I do like, I'm going to be doing more back to normal real TV next year. But in the space of time that I've talked to someone about doing a real TV show and getting it made and stuff, I've done 10 episodes of something else on the online and just done it for cheap. So I'm always seeking the talk show, we host, and Jason is a brilliant producer. And, so we have the contract to host and produce Pebble Beach, largest car event in the world. Nice. And it's our show. It's our chat show right there. And we're doing the same for the Chattanooga Motor Car Festival, which is coming up in 3 weeks in Chattanooga, Tennessee. And we love it. Really, really love it. But the goal is to get back to IMSA next year, do our other events, get back to IMSA. As much as anything, and I'm sure you get this, I want to get there for a big reason, which is the main show. It's how we get paid. And then be able to go and take pictures. It's like, it's going to be my Trojan horse to get in to go and do the things that I really care about. I just, my biggest regret, and I tell Dad the whole time, is why aren't I a trust fund kid? And he just says, you're not, you know, wouldn't it be great? I just travel the world, take pictures of beautiful people. It would be great. I'm not.
But you got to have a purpose, regardless of how much. You've got to have something that's driving you forward.
Yeah, yeah. And for me, it is, I have a passion for communicating the stories that I get from the people. You know, you've done a great job on this. But as you know, a lot of it is as good as your guest is. And I'm sure you've had guests and you go, Jesus Christ, I'm at 27 minutes here and we are just dragging this out. And then you find something that they want to talk about, right? And suddenly it's off.
And they go,
you go, thank God, you know, I didn't realize it, like historic cars so much. And it becomes an easy conversation. But, you know, what I do with Life with Legends is I'm sitting down with these guys. I mean, I was with Jackie Stewart in the summer and, you know, getting a lot of the older guys, obviously, first. But it's just a conversation. And because I'm one of them, not on the same level, but because I've walked that same walk, I feel I have the ability to ask things that maybe other people don't and discuss things. And so I hope people like it. And if they don't, I've got a really good conversation collection of a library of amazing conversations with extraordinary people.
Yeah. And you must have been like, do you find, because I found through, I don't know what number this will be, this is like 153 or something of these sort of interviews I've done. And I've learned so much about myself and interviewing, but I can only imagine, like, you've done this for so long and picked up so much. Are you still like, your brain, I presume my brain is always in the background, like working, trying to sort of see how we might go. But then also at the same time, you've got to listen. That's something
I'm learning. That's the only thing.
What have you picked up or sort of on the way?
Well, Chris Economaki. Do you know who Chris Economaki was? Chris Economaki was, if you Googled him, you'd be pretty impressed. He was the original American motorsport commentator. He was the voice of the first Indy 500 on TV. He started off doing the Daytona Beach road races back in when they were on the sand. Yeah. And he developed his skills as a radio announcer. I mean, one of my favorite stories of Chris, he said, I was down at, let's just say, the south turn of the track. People all in the grandstands. Everyone's getting bored because it's the same three cars at the front in the sand and the dirt flying everywhere. So he thought, I know, I'm going to lie. They started to get up out of their seats. So he started going, I just got word that up in turn one, there's been an amazing pass for the lead. Now we have, you know, Dan Gajani, you know, make you say, you know, has just taken the lead. Oh my God, they're heading back towards us now. Everyone sits down, you know, like this. Next thing is they come, there's obviously been a retake for the lead. They're back in their original position. He did this lap after lap. He realized that it's just entertainment. Feed them. And then he said, so I love that story. So then I said to him, Chris, when I started doing TV, how can I be better at this? What can I do? And he said, just goddamn listen. Know where you want to get in and where you want to get out. And in between, just listen. And that's what I do. And I think I do it on live TV. I will go into, you know, I opened the beginning of the Le Mans 24 Hour going out globally for Fox Sports at the time, or Speed Channel. And I'm the first person they see. And I know how I'm starting and I know how I'm ending. And in between, I'm going to see where it takes me. And I love the thrill of that. But you do learn a lot about yourself when you watch other people. Like, I remember watching Jeremy Clarkson. I'm like, okay. So I did a show and I was like, this car gives me these feelings that only like a wild horse riding naked, you know, in a leather codpiece could do for me. I'm totally making this up. And I watched myself back and all it was like, blah, 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 blah. I mean, it's just not me. I'm the guy that delivers things faster and I'm energetic and I'm funny and I really engage the camera as opposed to, and I realized he does it his way, I do it my way. I can't be him. He can't be me. And you try and emulate people, right? You look and you go, oh, I need to do it better. But it doesn't. You just got to stick to your own way of doing it, to be honest.
And try a little bit of this, a little bit of that.
Oh, Definitely try. But it's funny. You look back and you go, I'm really not that guy. But it's a bit like me when I never had a golf lesson. But, you know, when I used to try and play golf, I'd be on the range and I'd look and that guy holds his grip like that. That guy has his ass stuck like that. I'd mix everything. I'd look around until I came up with my own version of it. People, I think, you know, lockdown was good for all of us who do podcasts, obviously, and who communicate, because you were able to talk to people through this at home with no masks. And I think it opened up a lot of opportunity. And I think there's room for everybody. I'm sure you've had it said, oh, Sam, why are you bothering? There's, you know, too many other chat podcasts. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But that's like saying you're never going to have a conversation other than with your best mate, you know, because there's a different take on it. You're always going to have a different thought to someone else. And that's why I love them. I think it's more the merrier. And there's no threat to each other, you know, by supporting each other's podcasts and promoting them, because it's just a different voice.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's all of the lockdown and all that. Like I started this podcast, and then a ton of my guests started podcasts. Like a lot of my guests have started podcasts since. And I got a bit like, oh, that's annoying.
Yeah.
I was like, no, it's not annoying. They're different. No. Different people doing different
stuff. Totally like, different.
I mean, whatever.
Just look at late night TV. You have more than one choice of late night TV on, you know, would you really think there's room for another late night TV and chat show? And of course there always is. So no, but this has been a pleasure, mate. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. Thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you.
It's been great.
Yeah, really, no, really good. Yeah, good luck with everything. And let me know where I can promote it and I'll do it.
Yeah. Have you got any social media handles or whatever you want to chat out?
Justin Bell TV is across everything, and check out Leica Racer if you like photography, at Leica Racer on Instagram, or Life with Legends podcast. I've only got four up right now, but I haven't really promoted it. So right after I get off this, you've motivated me. I've got to start pushing it.
Yeah, well, people go have a listen, and thanks very much.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.